That's not a knife.
Nice. From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Andrew Richards in place for Gove.
Filling in for Gove again. Yeah, he's on vacation.
Yep.
So let's talk about last week. We've got a couple of comments and a little adjustment you want to make.
Yeah.
So Teacock and Brody Man said Outlook 2010 supports more than one Exchange client.
Yep. So what we're talking about in last week's episode was they wanted to have multiple Outlooks at the same time, like 2007 and 2010, which you can't do.
Yeah.
But then I postulated that they probably wanted it for multiple Exchange servers. And I said, that can't be done. And then I forgot and or got told that Exchange 2010, so Outlook 2010 supports multiple Exchange servers. And there's a TechNet article about how to configure that. The only slight difference to normal Outlook is that you can't configure it through just add accounts on the homepage. You actually have to go to that mail applet, which I showed you last week.
Mm-hmm. So. Cool. Okay. All right. And then you had another one you wanted to revisit, the holding down Control Shift.
Yeah. So so when we were talking about bringing up the host file elevated. Yeah. And so I was using, that's the run dialog on this one. We were talking about completion working in here fantastically, so you don't have to type as much.
Mm-hmm.
Drivers, etc. Hosts. And then what I was doing was putting Notepad on the front, and then you get the entry at the top. And before I lose this, I went run as administrator because the host file is protected, so you need to run as administrator to edit it. And you open it, and you don't get the host file.
Yeah.
And I still need to look into see if this is a bug or not, but it seems like it's a bug. So two of my friends, Aaron Margosis and Trey Nash, both pointed out that you actually can still do this. So once it's in the run bar, if you hold down Control and Shift, and it can be the left or the right one,
mm-hmm.
and press Enter, any application that you start invokes the USC elevation prompt, and then in this case,
very nice,
it works. So if I want to run like Media Player elevated, I can just hold Control and Shift when I click it, and
cool,
and up comes Media Player elevated.
Awesome.
So yeah, much quicker way of getting to an elevated prompt.
Very cool. Okay. All right. And we had a message from Kevin Armstrong, who said a slightly extended suggestion to your suggestion about auto login for a home computer is to make a shortcut in startup to lock your computer. So we talked last week about you want to boot your computer up all the way, but then have it lock. And we talked about a couple different ways to do this. And we've got a couple new ones.
Yeah. So you came through the control at Dell screen with auto runs. Oh, sorry, auto login from sysinternals.
Yeah.
And then we said just use the screensaver. But
yeah,
the way that this person suggested was to run this command. So what you do is say, I want to lock the workstation. And so looking at this command line, you go, well, really, what is it? And so where's my IE gone? So what there is there's a function called lock workstation in user 32.
Mm-hmm.
And normally you would have to grab this code, compile it as a C program, and end up with an exe called, I don't know, lockstation.exe. And then you could run it as a scheduled task. And this is what this guy was suggesting. I'll run it as a scheduled task, or put it in your run key, or even in your startup folder. If you want to make sure that it's there, you could like publish it by group policy and enforce it's there.
Yeah.
But it's kind of laborious to compile this, right? And so, as I said, there's this program called RunDLL32, and it was Microsoft internal, but people kind of discovered it, and it's so useful that it kind of leaked out, and it's now
only lasts so long.
Now supported. So what it does is you can say for any DLL, run a function in it. So
yeah,
if you have this command line, you can lock your workstation. So schedule tasks, so you would schedule it as a run at login task.
Yeah.
Or as we said, in the run key.
So the idea is your computer would boot all the way up using the auto login, and then you would use this and it would lock it again.
And it would kick it in within the first couple of seconds, hopefully. And nice. You're relatively
safe. So you
can
just hit your power button, go get your coffee, come back, you're all ready to go as soon as you log in.
Yep.
Very nice. And is there any security issue around getting around this?
Not at all, no. Because you could publish it by group policy, as I said, so that it absolutely enforces that it's there.
Very cool.
And you can also set it up in the as an administrator, you could say you can't delete this from the run key. You could set permissions on it saying, look, it's locked in there, you can't delete it. So
cool.
I mean, obviously, awesome. As an administrator, you can do anything.
But, yeah. All right, so we've got a question from Rod. It says, tonight I had my PC up, syncing my Zune HD while watching TV. I finished syncing, unplugged it, went to move the mouse to click a window, can't remember what, and I got a blue screen of death. This is my primary PC at home. Whenever anything like that happens, I tend to get scared, thinking of all my financial data. I think we all do this.
Yeah.
The source code for programs I work on, important photos, etc. And he didn't know what the blue screen of death was telling him. Before he could start paying attention to it, it was gone. The machine rebooted. A little later, it said that the dump was saved to C Windows memory dump. I found it's large, rather large, 800 meg. I'm guessing some other device driver is causing a problem, but I can't figure out which. The closest thing I can find to something useful is XML that says, in part, there's some XML here.
Yeah.
Doesn't look all that helpful, and I suspected the provider name is just the .NET library that's being used to report the error, not the error itself.
It
I'm not a system admin, but I do have this dump files. There's some useful utility I can run to download and find out what's causing all the problem.
So, blue screens of death it's a big topic, and we'll dedicate a show to this at some point. It's easily a half hour plus topic. What I'll talk about is how you can kind of quickly guesstimate to where what the issue is. In fact, in this situation, I actually can tell you what went wrong, even though all I have is one little number. So when you have a blue screen of death, the internal Microsoft way of calling that is called a bug check.
Mm-hmm.
The OS is saying something really, really bad has happened and I don't want to run the risk of corrupting more data. I'll just shut the machine down right now.
Yeah.
And what happens is it dumps the memory into a file. And actually, it goes from the memory and it puts it into the page file. So the page file needs to be the right size to fit that. So there's three types of dump files for bug checking, for blue screens. There is a mini, a kernel, and complete. A mini's tiny, it's like 60K. Kernel is variable. So on an x86 machine, you're somewhere in the realm of 1 gig for a 4 gig of RAM, plus or minus a bit. And then complete is 1-to-1. So if you have 4 gig of RAM, it's 4 gig of dump file. So the whole file thing, yes, we can analyze it to the nth degree, and that's what I do every single day at Microsoft for people. But it's a much bigger topic. What I can quickly give you is that in the event log, which is what this person sent us, there is this text. And the provider in this case is Windows Error Reporting, which is the subsystem that tells Microsoft something's going wrong.
Yeah.
So we can track global trends of issues. So the important, there's one tiny piece of important information on that screen, and it's the bug check number. And in Windows 8, instead of giving you the number, they now give you the textual description of it. So there's like a pairing. So in this case, it said I had a bug check 116.
Yeah.
And there is hundreds of them. You can see all the numbers here. And here's that name I was talking about on the right and the number on the left. So purely based on 116, I know it's a video TDR error, which is a timeout error on a video device, which means the video stack crashed. And they try to restart the video stack, as in the kernel tries to start like NVIDIA or ATI's code.
Yeah.
And then that timed out while it was trying to restart, which probably meant that the hardware was so locked up it couldn't. And because there was no video left, it went, well, that's it, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
So in this case, I would say update your video drivers, as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
If that doesn't fix the issue and it comes back again, then we can move on to the dump file to work out a little bit more information about what went wrong. And then escalate as appropriate. So if you're contacting Defrag about this, there is two files which you get. So you'll get a big file, Windows defaults to kernel, which means it's going to be about 500 meg to a gig. And like I forced a crash in my box right there. So memory.dump is what you'll get in the Windows folder. That is enough to answer the question in most cases. We don't need a complete, a kernel's enough.
Yeah.
There is another folder though, at the same time, so I crashed this on April 12th. This is what gets sent to Microsoft, right? And this is enough for me to give you a gist.
Yeah.
So if you have a crash that you want us to have a look at, go to C Windows Mini Dump and zip up that DMP file, send it through, and we can get further.
Awesome. So the suggestion, to help fix the problem that he had, video card drivers.
Simple as that. Yep. Update NVIDIA or update ATI. Without, I mean, I'm purely basing it on one single number.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not a bad jump, really. I got from there to there.
Okay, so. And if you go back to that webpage where you're showing the different numbers.
So most of the numbers have what to do. So if you say, you know, it'll explain what every single...
And so this number that you typically see that's 0x, bunch of zeros, and some number or letter there, and I've seen those when I crash like that before. That's what you got before in like Windows 7, and now in Windows 8 you see the text level number violation.
Yeah, they've given you the name. So instead of Googling the number you would do the name instead.
Cool.
So sometimes on the screen it also will give you the name of the driver that it thinks is at fault.
Yeah.
So put those two together in Bing and you know like mutex level and you know bad.sys.
Yeah.
And see if there's a patch out there for you.
Awesome.
So Microsoft only gives you Windows updates of hardware certified drivers.
Yeah.
So as I think we've talked about this before. OEMs on their websites will have newer versions that they haven't gone through the Microsoft vetting process yet. So you can jump across to like Dell and HP and IBM and get their drivers, which may be more up to date.
Great. All right, next question from Eddie Davidoff, which he had this right justified email that he sent. His email was completely right justified.
There's a keystroke for that. I think it's like Control R, which causes that. So I'm wondering if it's by purpose or not.
It really kind of messed with my brain trying to read his email.
It was very hard to read. And it had a question mark on the front of every comment of every sentence, too.
It was very interesting style, and I thought about it for a while. I was like, that's it certainly stands out.
I remember it.
Yeah. But it really kind of screwed with my head. But anyway, he said, I have an Asus P8Z68V Pro motherboard for a couple of months, got a new desktop PC, and from the get-go, I've been having an issue with it. It takes, at the very best, 23 seconds from the moment I push the power button to the moment it gets to the OS selection menu. So my question is there a problem with the motherboard, or is it normal for Asus boards to be slow to boot? I've read others that have similar problems with this model, and if this is the normal time it takes for a desktop motherboard to finish a post, 20 to 30 seconds at best, how can Microsoft get those magical numbers under 10% boot time, or 10 seconds boot time, provided one has an SSD, if the post alone takes 2 to 3 times longer than that? So Gove wrote back and he said, yeah, we don't boot test, you know, timing with motherboards, but, you know, check if there is an artificial spin up on the hard drive, and he wanted more information on that.
So
what suggestions do you have here?
So when a machine boots, it's called POST, which is power on self-test.
Yeah.
And what that does is it runs a program. And that program is the BIOS. The BIOS is a program. And on newer motherboards, it's called UEFI, which is Unified Extensible Firmware Interface.
Yeah.
So BIOS is designed in, like, when IBM PC, was that 1980?
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
And so it has limitations, and it can't handle like a large number of CPUs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole world is slowly moving to UEFI. But in general, just think of it, everything as BIOS still.
Yeah.
So that's a program that runs, and that's all that black screen stuff you see in the blue menu. You can choose things. So the question is, what is post-checking?
Mm-hmm.
Right, and that's what the delay is. So Gove's suggestion is probably the highest probability. Newer motherboards have more and more SATA controllers on them, you know, 8, whatever it is, 12.
Yeah.
And if you've got it set to say, look for a hard drive, you know, the automatic settings,
yeah,
it has to, every single port, go, are you there?
Hard drive here.
And a lot of these posts have delays waiting for the physical platters to spin up, which can take, I don't know, 2 or 3 seconds maybe. Add that all together and you have a delay. And so if you change all the hard drives that don't exist to none or disabled, all those checks will be skipped and it should be faster. All right, so that's purely the hard drive one.
Yeah.
The other things you've got is things like boot from LAN. So if you, a lot of corporations use boot from LAN to automatically image servers and stuff. If you're at home, you're not booting from LAN.
Yeah.
Disable that option in the BIOS.
Yeah.
The other one that you get is, which tends to be like press Control L or some other keystroke now, and you see some scrolling text. Well, what's happened is the BIOS has offloaded part of the execution to an individual card that you've got in your like your PCI Express slot, like a RAID controller or something like that.
Yeah.
And so it's actually gone and started its version of the BIOS, so the BIOS on that card, and it's waiting for that program to work. Usually in the main BIOS, you can say, I don't want to do RAID, disable that feature, it won't go to that program. It won't time out waiting for you to press Control L for 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Another 5 seconds saved. All right. So the other thing about timings.
What about boot order? Does not having a CD drive as the top of the boot order
speed
it up?
If you've got A drive at the top, it's going to go blip, blip. Is A drive there?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
half a second. CD-ROMs, same
thing. It all adds up.
All adds up. So everything you can move it to the latest and greatest is mm-hmm. the best. If you need to boot from CD-ROM, it's pretty rare. In fact, it's probably more annoying that you left the disk in there by mistake and it booted the CD-ROM.
Yeah.
Just change it in the BIOS when you need it.
Yeah.
Refine the BIOS.
All these things add up. So if you can take out some of those.
Yeah.
And
the other thing about to be aware of is that there's two types of boot. There's what's called a hard boot, which is when the power's turned off, and there's a soft boot. And so even though the power was turned off and the BIOS is still running as if it's a brand new box, when you come back from sleep, it goes, hey, I know that the memory's still full because I've been trickle-feeding a battery to it. I know that everything must be configured, ergo, and my state is still sitting in memory. I'll skip BIOS. So the BIOS still runs. So when you do a resume from sleep, that's why it's fast.
Yeah.
And that's actually how Windows 8 achieves its speed, is that it actually has this trickle configuration in underneath.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Next question. After reinstalling Windows 7, some of the file names are now in blue ink. Why is that?
So I'm going to make some files. I'll make a bitmap just to be different. Okay, so normally files are black.
Yes.
All right. So if you go under Properties, under Advanced on the file, you have two options, Compress and Encrypt. So if you choose Compress and press OK, it comes up blue.
Cool.
Right? So okay. If you have a folder that's compressed, then anything that you copy into it will be compressed. So probably what this person did, because they were recovering a machine that was bad,
mm-hmm.
most things are compressible and not. It doesn't really hurt you that they're compressed on the hard drive. And so they probably copied the entire person's collection across, put it into a compressed folder just to make it a little bit smaller.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, so that's blue. The other one, and I can't do it because I have Home Premium, is Encrypt.
Yeah.
And Encrypt comes up green. This is exclusive, so it's an OR thing. You can't have both at the same time. So you can't say what's blue and green added together.
Yeah.
It's an OR thing. So it's like a radio button.
Cool.
So that's green. So pretty simple. So if you want to undo it, you can just right-click on the folder and say, apply this to all files underneath, or
yeah.
you just do it one by one. But there's no reason to get rid of it. It doesn't really hurt performance much.
Okay. Awesome. Next question. I'm currently trying to do some physical debugging with one of our devices. It would be very helpful to be able to use the command to output a list of available wireless devices to the command line or to a file, which I could then run a diff on later. Is there a way to do this in Windows 7?
Yep. So I just use Control Shift to bring up a MN command prompt.
All right.
This actually, I think, works from standard anyway. So there's a thing called the network shell, and it's like a command prompt. It's got its own language and lets you investigate anything about the network. So if you press question mark, it will show you all the things that are pertinent to this issue. So the first level is things like firewall, and what's important in this case is this person wants to know what wireless LANs are out there. So if I change context to wireless LAN, do a question, there's a show area question, and then and the one we want in this one is there's profiles, so that's all the ones that you've got registered for personal use, and the one that they need in this case is show networks. So this is all the Wi-Fis that my machine can currently see.
Very nice.
And there's the other one that's in here is, I think it's interfaces for memory. Yeah, so it shows me what my Wi-Fi adapter is. So you don't have to be in the shell to do this. So every command kind of was like net shell, then WAN, then show. And so you can just do that in one straight line out here. So you don't actually have to go into the command prompt.
Mm-hmm.
And so networks. And you get the same thing. So then you can pipe it to a file, and there's your test.
Awesome. All right, next question. Does anyone know where to create a keyboard shortcut in Windows 7? For instance, I would like to bind a launching of a browser to a keyboard shortcut. Do you know how to do it? This one pretty simple.
Do you want to do it?
Yeah, right-click, properties, so keyboard shortcut.
I'm going to do it even on something on the menu.
Yeah.
Right there.
So there's a keyboard shortcut.
Type something.
Right here,
so it's media player, Control-Alt-M.
Yeah. And so it's a Control-Alt keyboard shortcut. Mm-hmm. It's not like typical ones where you hit the Windows key and something.
No, you can only use Control-Alts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's an easy way to do that.
So then, oh. That's weird, didn't we?
Did you do Control-Alt?
I didn't. That was Control. Oh, did I press OK? Anyway,
that's how it works. Yeah, I think you pressed OK. All right, next question. I'm trying to fine-tune my mouse scroll wheel behavior. When I go to Control Panel, Mouse Properties, there's a setting for the scroll wheel. The minimum allowable setting is one line, but that's too much. How do I set this to be less than one line? Optimally, I want this to be one pixel at a time. That's interesting. I've got the Arc Touch mouse, and I'd also kind of like to do that.
Yeah, so the way that the mouse works is it makes what's called WM mouse wheel events for this particular thing.
Yeah.
Right? And a mouse wheel event actually says, by the way, this button's down at the same time, the left button, the middle button, the right button, and it also tells you how much roll you did. So the way that Windows works is that roll actually is in gradients of 120 increments.
Yeah.
All right. This is where it kind of gets confusing, so bear with me. So in the mouse dialog, you can say how many notches a click is worth. And so if you click one forward in the old traditional, like these ones where it actually has a feel of a click,
yeah,
then you'll get one mouse wheel increment, which is 120. And then you can say, I want three, and then it will give you three every single notch. Right, so you can bring it down to one. So what happens is you get one event sent to the application, and it says, I moved 120. And actually, Microsoft has a reserve that you are allowed to, the mouse driver is allowed to give a non-120 increment in the future. So the question is, what does the application do when it receives that? And it's up to the application. So mm-hmm. when it's things like Word and very textual-based things, it treats 120 as divided by wheel increment, which is a constant, 120, equals one, I'm going to move one line. Right, things like Paint, on the other hand, if I print screen this onto here, so it's bigger than, print screen this, so it's much bigger than I can see. If I scroll in here, it is proportions of the scroll bar, so it's not really a line per se. It's just like 120 pixels.
Yeah.
So it's kind of arbitrary what programs do. The answer, no. It comes down to the application. Yes, you could write a device driver that goes and changes these sub-increments to less than 120, but in general, no, you can't. That's as good as it gets.
All right. Next question. If I were to execute all executables in Windows in command, does that mean that I need to add all folders containing executables to path? Coming from Linux, this seems like a huge hassle. Is there a way to automate or simplify the process?
So when you run a process, under the hood, it runs a function called create process always. And this MSDN documentation actually gives you a clue as to what happens. So first thing it does is it tries to run the executable from where the executable came from. So if you're running CMD, which is running in System32, it will try to run the name in that folder first, and then it will say the current directory of the current process. So if you've changed directory into ctemp, it will try temp. Then it will try System32, and this actually needs to be updated for, 64-bit, so it has that as well. It will do the system directory if you support 16-bit programs still, which is x86 builds. And then the Windows directory, so C:\Windows, and then it will look at your path. So the path is not the only thing that is looked at. If it's not in all of those, then yes, you need to qualify the way to get to the file. There is one sneaky way around this, right? So there's a program called Start. And what it does is it looks up the registry for more things. So like when you run things in the start bar, it's roughly the same thing. it knows how to get to more programs than what's on the path. And so there's some programs where you'll type it at the command prompt and it won't work. But if you go start space, exactly the same thing, it'll work. And the Internet Explorer is a good example of that. So if you're not finding it on the path, try start space the thing, and then you'll have to fall back to either adding it to the path or just fully qualifying it when you actually want to use it.
Awesome. All right, next question. Well, next question, there is no next question. It's pick of the week time.
Pick of the week.
Pick of the week. So
you want to do yours first?
No, you brought a book. Let's see your book.
So last week I talked about the Windows Internals book.
Yeah.
So Windows Internals is about how the OS works under the covers.
Yeah.
And last week also you saw me use a lot of SysInternals tools. So to know how to use the SysInternals tools well, you kind of needed to know what's happening under the covers, which is why I mentioned that on the book.
Yeah.
But there is I even have a copy of the book right here, a definitive guide to the SysInternals tools. Mark Krasinovich and Aaron Margosis wrote it. Aaron Margosis was the primary author of it. And I actually reviewed this book. I was actually the reviewer of it. Great book, if I don't say so myself.
Yeah.
400 or 500 pages, $30. It goes through every single SysInternals tools, what all the command line options are, why you want to use it, and there's a whole lot of case studies in there as well. So if you're into troubleshooting issues,
The
SysInternals tools are without a doubt the best tools around. And if you want to know about the best tools, you should get the best book around about it. So
excellent. And we're going to do some videos on SysInternals tools.
We are.
Too,
so we'll go through, cool. Roughly I'm going to go through the book and give a video presentation of each major part of the book at least.
Awesome. All right. Next pick of the week, Elder Scrolls. Come on, Skyrim. Here we go. They are adding Kinect support to the Elder Scrolls Skyrim, and you'll be able to do up to 200 voice commands now. So this is going to be a pretty cool way to play Skyrim. You can use your Kinect. There's no gesture support or anything like that, but there's going to be voice commands, so that'll be very cool.
So you can yell at the screen, don't do that! Yeah. Run away!
And then I had one other pick of the week that I wanted to talk about as well, and that is there's a report out that 1366 by 768 is now the most used screen resolution on the internet. So that's pretty cool. It's taken over from 1024 by 768 for most widely used. And that's good news if you're looking at Windows 8 in the future, because this will allow you
to dock
your other apps on the side. That's the minimum resolution that you need for that.
So it really shows the shift from 4x3 to widescreen.
Yeah, and it's good timing too. So as you start playing around with Windows 8, this will give you the opportunity to use that.
You can see defrag in the right ratio.
Yeah, awesome. So that's the show for this week. If you have questions, you can leave a comment on the show notes, or you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com. Prefer the email so we can go back and forth with you. And we will see you next time.
Have a good week.